So do you have anything either from the reading or from what we did Monday? You've got me all to yourself, so you might as well take advantage of what?
It's hard to understand.
Well, what things don't make sense?
So the difference between the all.
Welcome. Looks like a very small class today. I don't know why. I was just asking him if he had any things he didn't understand about the chapter, and you get to be next when he slows down. So you might think about whether there are particular things, if this is going to be a tutorial instead of a lecture today, whether there are particular things.
I have one question, and I guess it's... Maybe this relates to the purpose of your hypothetical.
Sure.
It's where the convicted criminal pays $1,000 fine to the state. So the net cost is zero because for every dollar the criminal loses, the state collects. And that's
and we're sort of assuming that the state has good things to use the money.
So it's a public benefit.
If you think of the tort equivalent, it's the plaintiff who collects. Now, you could argue if you believe the government has too much money, you might argue against it. You could say, well, they could always cut taxes to compensate. But at least at this level, a fine is a potentially efficient punishment.
So below that, there is where the criminal
can't pay,
so he's got to be incarcerated.
Right.
So included in the cost there is the cost of actually incarcerating.
Yes.
How come in the above scenario, where he pays $1,000, the cost of adjudicating that?
I guess because I'm assuming that that's already in, we've got one set of costs which I'm referring to as apprehension costs,
right?
And one that I'm referring to as punishment costs. And I assume that the apprehension cost doesn't depend on whether he's going to pay a fine or go to prison. And I'm including in the apprehension cost the trial. Right, you really have to not only catch him but convict him.
Okay.
So therefore, that's really being bundled in that.
The punishment is actually it's separate. Him away.
That's right.
Okay.
And then the underlying argument I'm going to make is that both apprehension cost and punishment cost per offense increase if you want to increase deterrence. That you have to either catch a larger fraction of the criminals, which includes trying a larger fraction, which costs more, or you have to punish them more severely, or both, and either of those increases costs. And on the other hand, as I go on to say, since if you deter crimes, you don't have to punish them, even though the cost per offense is going to go up, total cost could go up or down, depending on the effect on the number of offenses. All right, is that part of the argument is clear?
Mm-hmm.
All right. Right. I guess that was. Did you have questions? What? When you find out. Right. One of the things that I really sort of skipped over and probably shouldn't, if you think about it as sort of a formal analysis, is how you would get total cost of deterrence. If we think of deterrence as something that's being produced. And it's being produced in the form of, if you commit this crime, the expected probability is such and such. All right. You can produce it with a mix of two different inputs, probability and punishment.
Right.
Now, you could think, of course, of those having inputs too, but just at the simplest level are two different things. You could raise the level of deterrence either by hiring some more cops and catching more criminals, or in some other way raising the probability, or by raising what you do to them. For any given level of deterrence, any equivalent from the standpoint of the criminal, you could imagine a whole range of mixes of probability and punishment. So we can say we can get a certain amount of deterrence either by catching half the criminals and fining them $1,000, or by catching a tenth of the criminals and locking them up for a year, or by catching 100 of the criminals and boiling them in oil or something. And you want to imagine that for any level of deterrence, you look at all the alternative combinations and pick the lowest cost one. And that's the cost of getting that level of deterrence. I don't know how much regular economics you've had. This is equivalent to something that's sort of very standard in a price theory course, a microeconomics course, which is you imagine you have a firm, and we would like to have the firm's total cost function. We would like to know how much it costs to produce 1,000 widgets, 1,001 widgets, 1,002 widgets, and so forth, in order that we can deduce its marginal cost, the cost of each additional widget. Where do we get the total cost function from? We start out with a production function, which says, what combinations of inputs can be used to produce 1,000 widgets? What combination of inputs can be used to produce 1,001 widgets? The answer is not there is only one combination of inputs that can produce 1,000 widgets. That if you think about more realistically, if you use some more labor, you can be more careful not to waste materials, for example. So you can substitute labor for raw materials, or maybe capital for labor, or one kind of labor for another. So when you're working out the total cost curve, the way you do it is to say, imagine we wanted to produce 500 widgets. What are all the possible ways of doing it? Price each of those ways, given the costs of the inputs. Pick whichever input bundle is least expensive, that's the total cost of producing 500 widgets, because what we'll do it in the cheapest possible way. Repeat for 501, 502, 550, 600, 1,000, and so forth. We now have a total cost curve. We can now say for any quantity, what is the cost of producing that quantity at the lowest possible cost? We're just doing the equivalent here, except that this time, rather than a firm producing widgets, what we have is a legal system producing deterrence. So what I was saying was something I sort of skipped over last time and probably shouldn't have, is, have you had economics courses, micro courses or something?
Not at this law school.
Never.
Yes.
You may or may not remember the process by which you get from a firm's production function to its total cost curve. You want to know the total cost curve, how much it costs to produce any quantity of output, so you can figure out marginal cost and average cost and stuff like that. And the way you're, in theory, doing it is that for any value of output, you look at all the different input bundles, each of which would have produced that quantity of output. So you say, if we wanted to produce 500 widgets, we could do it by hiring 100 workers, buying lots and lots of raw materials and having a certain failure rate. We could do it with 200 workers, work much more carefully, and fewer raw materials. We could use capital and substitute machines for some of the workers and so forth. Consider each possible way of producing 500 widgets. Price each of them. For each of them, say, what would it cost us to buy those inputs? Whichever bundle is least expensive is the way that you would choose to produce 500 widgets. We now have a single point on the total cost curve. The total cost of 500 widgets is the cost of that input bundle. Now repeat for 600 widgets. Now for 700. Now for 800. You now have a total cost curve showing you if you want to produce any quantity of widgets, what it would cost to produce them. Produce it with the least expensive bundle of input that would produce that quantity. All right? Make sense?
Yeah.
What I'm saying is that we're really doing exactly the same thing. It's sort of neat to see that in this case, the economic analysis of law is just replicating conventional price theory microeconomics because we're producing an output deterrence. You can think of the amount of deterrence as the expected punishment, which we're thinking of as probability times punishment. It's really a little more complicated because you might be risk averse or risk preferring, but I'm going to ignore that. So we say, from the standpoint of the criminal, $1,000 fine paid with certainty is equivalent to a $2,000 with 50%, $4,000 with 25%, and so forth. All of those are the same output in terms of deterrence. They all have the same tendency to keep them from doing it. So just look at each of those and ask which is cheapest for us to produce, given the cost of catching and convicting people and the cost of punishing them. And we can raise probability by spending more on cops and prosecutors, and then we'll be able to collect fines instead of having to pay for jails. We can lower probability to save on cops and prosecutors, but then some of our defendants, when we convict them, will have to lock up, and that means we don't collect anything, we got to pay for the jail. So you could think, for any level of deterrence of all the different possible combinations, pick the cheapest one. All right, make sense? And that, we now have a total cost curve. We can now say, if we want deterrence that's equivalent to $100, this is what it'll cost us per offense. If we wanted 200, this is what it'll cost us. 300, this is what it'll cost us. So we now have a total cost curve and a marginal cost curve, just like in ordinary economics. Is that?
Yes.
that? All right. So I didn't really go through that. And since I've been talking about marginal cost, I thought I ought to make it clear where it comes from. Let me go back, since we're up to a grand total of three students, and try to do what you do, which was first a fairly quick review of what we did last time, with people stopping me whenever I come to something that you don't understand and have questions about, and then some stuff that I was just beginning to get into last time. So our first cut at criminal law is that we would like to deter all inefficient offenses, but only inefficient offenses. And an inefficient offense is one where the damage done to the victim is greater than the benefit to the offender of committing the offense. All right? This started as a class of one, which is why I ended up with somewhat different seating arrangement than usual, but that's all right. So our first approximation is that, and we have the answer to that from Pigou, that how would we, actually we have two answers. One way to permit efficient offenses is to special case them, in the case where the legal system can see that they're efficient, and that's the doctrine of necessity case, for example. But the other way is Pigou's answer, which is we just impose an expected punishment equal to the damage done, and now the offenders will self-sort. They will reveal how much it's worth to commit the offense by whether they do or don't choose to commit it. Exactly the way that people exactly the way we allocate apples. All right, we would like to allocate apples to those people who value them at more than their cost. How do we do it? They're available on the market at their cost. Those people who value it at more than that buy it. Those who don't, don't. So the underlying principle of a decentralized system where your own actions reveal your values is being applied to both cases. All right? What's wrong with that argument? And you can see the answer from two sides. One of them is that the conclusion doesn't make sense. Because the conclusion is that what limits how high a punishment we impose is that we don't want to deter efficient offenses. And you then think about the actual murder rate and ask yourself, do you really think it is likely that the reason we don't punish murder more severely is we're afraid there wouldn't be enough murders? And that doesn't feel at all right in terms of this society or anyone that I know about. And you then look at it in terms of the theory and you say, what have we left out? We've left out the cost of deterring offenses, the cost of catching and punishing people. That once you realize it's costly, now you don't want to deter all inefficient offenses. You only want to deter those offenses that are inefficient enough, so deterring them is worth what it costs. All right, so far? So you have an offense which hurts him by $1,000 and benefits you by $900. In terms of our previous discussion, that's an inefficient offense. Net cost $100. Suppose, however, that raising the punishment, suppose our punishment was $899 fine, and at that punishment you commit the offense, but you have a $900 benefit from it. All right. So we're thinking about raising the fine to $901, either by making the punishment more severe, which might mean some people go to jail, or by catching a larger fraction of offenders. And that'll deter that offense. So deterring that offense will create a net social benefit of $100. You're $900 worse off, he's $1,000 better off, because you're now not mugging him or stealing his car or whatever you were doing. If, however, in order to raise the expected punishment from $899 to $901, we've got to hire an extra cop at a cost of $200, then we're paying $200 for a $100 benefit, but worse off as a result. All clear. Make sure. So that then tells us that perhaps the reason we don't deter more murders is not that we want those murders to happen, but only that it is too costly to deter them. And the cost could take different forms. It could be having to hire lots more cops. It could mean lots more prisons. It could mean lowering our standards of proof and convicting more innocent people as a result. But in one dimension or another, there is a cost there which we aren't willing. And then the next step is, can we make the argument more precise? Can we say not merely that we have to take account of cost, but just how? And the argument there, which I went through last time, but I'm going to go through it again because I time to afford it. And besides, I now have some wonderful new markers. I finally got around to asking the office if they had them, and they did. So here the argument is that we would like one offense of reducing the number of muggings by one equals damage that the offense would do minus benefit to criminal.
All with me so far.
All right. What do we gain by reducing the number of muggings by one? We save the damage that would have been done, but at the expense of the mugger not having the fun of mugging him. All right. Or the money he steals from you, whatever it would have been. Benefit to criminal for the marginal offense. Imagine that this is our expected punishment, our probability times punishment. So if we're talking about changing that by a little bit, the offense we eliminate is going to be one whose benefit to the criminal is just about equal to the expected punishment. That was my 899 to 901 eliminates an offense that benefited you by $900. Argument clear?
Still.
All right. So that, for the marginal offense, is damage minus expected punishment. We are willing to raise the punishment a little bit in order to cure one more offense, only if that benefit is at least as large as the cost. So we keep doing it until the last offense that we're eliminating is one where the benefit of eliminating is just equal to the cost. Then we stop. All right. So we want this equal to marginal cost. If it costs, if we get a $100 net benefit from eliminating that mugging, because it's a $1,000 mugging that does you $900 worth of good, then we want to do it to eliminate them until we get to the point where the cost of eliminating one more is 100. Now all we have to do is to reorganize this, and we have expected punishment, adding to that and subtracting to that, equals D minus MC. All right? That's the basic algebra of the logic of the problem. And then the only remaining step is to observe that marginal cost could be either positive or negative, because imposing a more severe punishment will cost more per offense, but it will also reduce the number of offenses that we have to punish. So if the supply of offenses is quite inelastic, if raising the punishment doesn't have very large effect on the number of offenses, then there will be a positive marginal cost. But if a increase in the punishment that increases punishment cost per offense by 10% reduces the number of offenses by 20%, then total cost is going to go down. All right, so far? Yes? No? All right. So that tells us that the optimal punishment will be below the damage done if marginal cost is positive. That's my murder case. It will be above the damage done if marginal cost is negative. That's the case where you were deterring some of the offenses so as not to have to punish them or apprehend them. All right? That's the basic argument that far.
I have a question with regard to punishment of the murderers.
Yes.
And re-exactly the context, but to make his punishment, I guess, a deterrent, it was like the torture?
I don't know. I think I said if you were following the Gouvian rule, if you were trying to make the expected punishment equal to the damage done, since you don't catch all the murderers, you're going to have to make the punishment larger than one life, which is the damage he's done. And that's why I was imagining you torture him, or you kill his family, or you bury him in unhallowed ground, the way they used to do with suicides, if they believe in life after death, and they care what kind of ground they're buried in, and so forth. You can think of lots of variants of that idea. If he's a Muslim, you sew his corpse up in a pigskin or something. I think that was. Yep.
So in a situation where the benefit to the criminal outweighs the damage done by a large amount, is that not worth preventing?
Might not be.
There's a negative marginal cost. That
unless there's a sizably negative marginal cost. That's right. And of course, in practice, we don't think of those as crimes, right? I mean, let's see. All four of us are criminals because only one of us dressed in a properly formal fashion so that the general scenery of Santa Clara University would impress people, right? So one could argue the decision of the four of us to dress in a relatively casual and sloppy fashion imposed some very small costs on the outside world, benefit to us, so, but we don't treat that as a crime, don't bother. And part of the reason is that we don't bother to treat as crimes things where it's obvious the benefit is hugely larger.
Well, it's been, I guess that's a shift away from a lot of crimes of moral character, right? But it's not actually the victim is not in crimes or whatever, or sodomy is probably a good example of that. There's a damage done to people around. Nowadays, most people don't care.
Right.
And it goes down. Is that one way of looking at that change? Perhaps?
That is one way of looking at it. If you imagine that those laws were done on sort of economic analysis of law grounds,
right.
The argument for a sodomy law would be, there were a number of possible arguments. But one of them could be many people in the population find disgusting this practice, and knowing that the practice going on will hurt them more than not being allowed to. A different explanation would be it was at one time widely believed that Sodom and Gomorrah were fiercely punished by God for having sodomy. I think there's a good deal of evidence that if they were punished by God, it was for inhospitality and some other things. Put aside that argument. So if you really believe in that, that's serious. I think if you actually look at the passage, it looks as though the crime being committed by the locals is treating a couple of visiting angels very badly. But in any case, whatever if you believe that doing certain things will bring divine vengeance not just on the people who do them but on their neighbors, then it's not unreasonable for the neighbors to say, we don't want you to do those things, right? In a way, that's exactly the same as the logic about current environmentalism. That the argument for environmentalism is when you burn a fire that puts carbon dioxide into the air, you aren't just affecting yourself, you're affecting all of us, and therefore we'll stop you. And that makes just as much sense if you believe the causal links to say that if you refuse to worship God and God gets mad at you and the lightning hits us too, therefore we're going to make you worship God, kind of thing. So that covers that stuff. And then the other, yeah.
I was going to say, so this is kind of the necessity defense too, in some way?
You're saying the necessity defense says you couldn't deter me, so therefore, in order to deter me, you'd have to impose enormously high punishment, be very expensive, therefore you're going to have a big minus MC, and therefore we're not going to punish it. That would be a way of thinking about it. I guess, yeah. But in that case, I mean, not deterring you at all is simply the simple solution. We know that if we happen to know the offense is efficient, but the necessity defense, just as in what I was discussing with regard to negligence, we've really got two mechanisms for controlling people's behavior. One of them is someone else decides what you should do and makes you do it, as by deciding when they'll hold you negligent, or by deciding that breaking into that cabin isn't a crime. The other is we arrange so that you bear the relative costs and benefits and then you choose. And the latter has a big advantage if the right answer depends on information you have and the court doesn't have. It may also have an advantage if it makes it in your interest to find the right answer and we don't have a way of making it in the court's interest to find the right answer. That's another problem. In a sense, if we go back to the discussion of regulation as a solution to externalities, the two fundamental problems with direct regulation were A, the regulator doesn't have the information, and B, he may not have the right incentives. And that kind of tension, the tension we were seeing between Pigouvi and Kosygin and regulatory solutions to externalities, runs all through the legal analysis. That you know, if you have perfectly wise courts, no problem, they just tell people what to do and punish them for not doing it. But courts are something between perfectly wise and perfectly ignorant. And therefore, in a sense, the strategy is to do as much as you can by giving people the right interest and letting them reveal stuff. And when you can't do that, you patch up by the other method, as it were. That's one way of looking, at least, at what we're doing.
I guess value the damage done to the criminal, we can look into both positive and negative externalities. We should, yes.
Yeah, one of the questions I haven't discussed, and I don't know if I have enough to say about it, is why we don't take seriously reverse torts. By reverse torts, I mean that I sue you on the grounds that I did a benefit for you. A positive externality, and if we want to control negative externalities by your suing me, then we should control positive externalities by my seeing you. Then I have the right incentive to produce the positive externalities. And it's pretty clear that with very few exceptions, our legal system doesn't let us do that. The only case I know of is the doctor who treats an unconscious patient who is entitled to sue for his customary pay, even though there was no consent. And presumably, I guess the argument could be that positive externalities are easier to handle through the market than negative ones, but it isn't always true, because really, public goods are a positive externality. So imagine the case where what I do is to broadcast a radio program, which everybody within range can listen to. That's a positive externality. And if you apply the tort system, I would then sue everybody in range, perhaps requiring some kind of evidence they listen to my station, which might be hard to produce, on the grounds that they ought to have to pay me. And instead, what we, insofar as you do it at all, we do it through the government and taxation. But in any case, so a point I made last time that I want to repeat is the ambiguity of the term efficient offense. Because we started out using an efficient offense to mean an offense which benefited the criminal by more than it hurt the victim. And at that level of analysis, what we want to do is to permit those but prohibit all the rest. And what we were really saying, though we didn't put it that way, is an inefficient offense is an offense where the world would be better off if the criminal chose not to commit it. So that's really looking at efficiency and inefficiency from the criminal standpoint, because the criminal can costly control himself. But then, once we start talking about the cost of deterrence, there's now a different sense that we talk about efficient or inefficient. Namely, is this an offense which it is efficient to deter, i.e. where the cost of deterring it is no more than the net damage done. And that's looking at the same question from the perspective of the legal system rather than the criminal, because the legal system can't just turn a switch and costlessly have you decide not to mug him, whereas you can. And the legal system says, is the one more cop hired, two more days in jail sentence, one fewer mugging, is that a net gain? If it's a net gain, then that mugging was inefficient. If it's a net loss, it was efficient in that sense. All right, let me... Other point which we discussed some, and I will go over only if people feel interested in going over it, is the methodological decision to count benefits to criminals. The argument that we're starting out, as it were, with a moral blank slate. All we want to put into it is the idea of economic efficiency, and if we're starting out that way, then we want to figure out our rules counting costs and benefits to everybody. And that's the method we're using, as opposed to the method that might seem more reasonable to some people, to say that costs to bad guys are a good thing and costs to good guys are a bad thing. And of course, I would reply, in our system, the only reason costs to bad guys are a good thing is because they prevent them from taking bad actions. And therefore, we don't have to treat the good guys and the bad guys differently. We just look at the consequences of the actions. That's what we've just been doing, after all. Yep.
So, when we're looking, I guess, take the moral equation out of the other moral part of the equation, when we're looking at people and how they value whatever, actually, what they value, the object being stolen,
right.
Or,
yep.
Or whatever,
yes.
It is, do we still consider there, if there is some sort of moral reason why they do something or any more reason why they do something?
In principle, we have to take utility functions as we find them.
Okay.
So if, let me take the clearest case, which is that when the mugger points a knife at you and says, give me your money, and you give him your money, one result is you feel humiliated. You say, what kind of a wimp am I that I let that guy make me give him my money? That's a cause.
Sure.
All right. We may have, you know, now I would say that it makes sense for the legal system to try to largely restrict itself to costs they can make reasonable estimates of. So that in that sense, there's an article by Bork, who was a prominent candidate for the Supreme Court and didn't make it. And the article I describe, I think, correctly as Bork explaining why he's not a libertarian. And it's an intelligent and thoughtful article. And the basic argument is that moral feelings count like any other feelings. And therefore, if the reason to forbid homosexual sex is that other people think it's sinful, that's just as good a reason as forbidding air pollution because it makes other people cough. In each case, all you do is ask, does it impose a cost on other people? If it does, then you have to take that into account and decide whether it's legal. And then, I don't know if you're familiar, John Stuart Mill uses the term self-regarding actions. For the actions you ought to have freedom with regard to, they don't affect anybody else. And Borger's saying there aren't any. As long as other people care about what you do, now what Mill thinks are self-regarding actions aren't, therefore there's no principle basis. And it's a legitimate argument. But one counter-argument is that if I can sue on the grounds that I say that something hurts me, we have an unworkable legal system, and that therefore it makes sense to distinguish between the kind of costs that are sort of physical and observable, like my greater chance of getting cancer because you put some stuff into my hair, and the kind of costs that are subjective, that are only subjective, such as my claim to be offended by your lifestyle. And to leave the latter out, despite the fact that a perfectly all-knowing court would put them in. So that would at least be my response. But I thought it was a neat article. I like to claim that Bork, as far as I know, is the only Supreme Court candidate who ever published an article explaining why he wasn't a libertarian and look what happened to him. So maybe if Richard Epstein ever gets nominated, he'll do that. We hope. That would be interesting, actually. Anyway, so next point, which I also went over, which I think is probably clear, but if it isn't, we can talk about it, is the idea of stigma as a particularly efficient punishment. And the argument is that if the punishment consists of the court generating information which causes other people to act towards the convicted defendant in a way that makes him worse off, that typically has negative costs. Because typically, the precautions that I take as a result of knowing that you're a burglar or someone who steals from his company or something benefit me by more than they cost you, and therefore there's a net benefit. And I don't know if people followed the experiment I proposed for how you could find out whether there was a net benefit by seeing whether you were willing to take a large enough cut in wages so that the employer would hire you as a treasurer in spite of your having stolen from your previous employer. If you are, then that means that the benefit to you of having a job is larger than the cost to them. You get the job, but I think it's much more likely that you won't, and therefore that suggests the cost to them of having someone who acts that way as their treasurer is higher than the benefit to you of the job. All right. I then went through a little bit my should the rich pay higher fines question, which to me at least is an interesting question. And the answer is that in the simple Pigouvian model they shouldn't, but in the model with enforcement costs, they sometimes should. And the reason is that the supply function for offenses is different, that it will require a higher punishment to prevent the rich man from slugging someone he's mad at than to prevent the poor man to do it in dollar terms, because dollars are worth more to the poor man than to the rich man. And so if you think about this marginal cost argument, the marginal cost depends on, as we raise the punishment, how much does the number of offenses go down? And depending on how the numbers turn out, it could well be the case that you can manage with a relatively low fine to the poor person on the grounds that the poor person, that would be enough to deter him, but it would take a large fine to deter the rich person. Yeah.
Would that be segmenting the market, or would that be a way of segmenting the market?
Yeah. Way of putting it, yeah, I think of it as price discrimination.
Oh, yeah.
Same basic idea. That's right. Now, a further point, which is pretty unambiguous, is that rich people can pay larger fines than poor people, and fines are a more efficient punishment. So, therefore, in general, that suggests that the cost of punishing the rich is lower than the cost of punishing the poor, which means higher punishment, since the marginal cost is a negative in there. But that's made complicated by the fact that the rich people have better lawyers. Some of you guys, maybe you're going to be in that job at some point, and so although it's cheap to punish them, it may be expensive to convict them. Those are going to go in kind of in opposite directions, obviously. All right, let me now go on to the subject that I don't think I actually got to, although you've now read it in the book, and it's the subject of one of my articles, and that's what I think of as the inefficiency of efficient punishment. And we start with my modest proposal for improving our legal system and saving lots of money, which, since we have budget problems, would obviously be a good thing. And this consists of making all offenses capital, but probabilistically capital. So if you'll remember from the book, the argument is you start out with an offense which is punished with a 60% chance of 10 years in prison. You do some market research and discover that from the standpoint of somebody planning a crime, a 60% chance of 10 years in prison is exactly the same cost to him as a 10% chance of being executed. All right, those are equivalent deterrent methods from his standpoint. Well, we say that's great, isn't that wonderful? After we convict you, we'll roll the die. 1 to 5, we send you home. 6 weeks, we hang you. And I claim it's an unambiguous improvement. The criminals, ex ante, are no worse off. It's true, some of them are better off and some of them are worse off because some of them win the die roll and some don't. But in an average sense, if it's true that they regard 6 chances of 10 years in jail as the same as 1 chance of execution, then they're no worse off. Deterrent effect is the same, so the victims are no worse off. And we can shut down all those jails, take all the money we'll save. And once you, if you're willing to accept that argument, we're going to carry it 2 steps further. The first step is, what's the point of arresting somebody, convicting him, and then sending him home? So we'll just cut the budget of our prosecutors and police until we're only catching and convicting 10% of the offenders and we're hanging all of them. And the other point, of course, is that we don't have to limit this to offenses that are serious enough to get 10 years in prison. We can do it for all offenses. Now, it's true that for a parking ticket, it'll be 1 chance in 10,000 of being hanged in order to get the deterrent out where we want it. But that's all right. That's fine. And actually, parking, we don't have to do it. We have fines for parking tickets. So it'll have to start out. So it's not for everything. It's for everything we would have used imprisonment for. So we can abolish all of the prisons except for jails where we hold people until we try them. And substitute hanging for all of it. That's the argument. And to me, at least, the question is, what's wrong with it? On the face of it, it seems like a logically coherent argument, and yet the result seems very bizarre. And you can take the argument, of course, a couple of steps further. Indeed, I think the problems become clearer if you take it further, because you say, wait a minute, it's true that execution is a more efficient punishment than imprisonment, because we have to pay for the prisons, but we can do better than execution. For example, you can enslave people. Penal slavery is historically a not uncommon form of punishment. And if we can get something out of them, in particular, if we can get more out of them than it costs to feed them and guard them, that's the critical question. If penal slavery produces less than the cost of feeding them and guarding them, then it's cheaper to hang them. But if it produces more, then it's more efficient to use penal slavery. And failing that, you can always execute them and have their organs forfeit for people who need transplants. You can save lives that way. So again, that's more efficient. And if for some odd reason you insist on imprisoning people, which doesn't seem on this argument like a very sensible thing, well, you can make the prison really unpleasant. Maybe you can flog them, use corporal punishment as well. And since as long as whatever changes you make keep the expected punishment on the criminal the same, criminals no worse off, victims are no worse off, enforcement system is saving money. So that's the full-scale system. And I should say, I've got an article on criminal law in England in the 18th century, which we'll be discussing a little bit in a couple of weeks. And it partly grew out of this argument, because, as you may know, 18th century English law is sometimes described as the Bloody Code, because it was a legal system where any offense more serious than stealing a sum of less than 40 shillings was capital. That's probably true at most, a slight simplification of it. So it was a system in which they essentially did not use imprisonment as a punishment for serious crime, and anything serious, the sentence was supposed to be death. And so I said, aha, look, this looks like they're really doing this. Let's see. And it turns out they aren't really doing this. We'll discuss that more later, but that got me interested. But in any case, so what's wrong with it? And my answer is that what's wrong with it is that we are leaving somebody out of our analysis, that we're thinking about the incentives of the criminal. We want him to have an incentive only to commit efficient crimes, loosely speaking. But we're not thinking about the incentives of the legal system. And that once you allow for the fact that whoever is running the legal system, just like the criminal, wants to maximize his own welfare, now these proposals become much more questionable. In particular, the all of the proposals in which it becomes profitable to punish people. It's a little trickier when you have to execute them, which is neither costly nor profitable. If we consider slavery for people who would actually pay to enslave, or organ transplants, both of those, you have the problem that it pays to punish people, and therefore it may be that they will be punished by whoever is controlling that system, whether or not, in terms of our argument, they should be. So that we can't, putting it a little differently, in my view and that of many other people, the fundamental mistake economists were making 50 years ago was in deciding what government should do, in analyzing the market realistically, and saying individuals in the market act for their own interest, but simply assuming that the government would do whatever was good. And therefore, the argument was, if there was anything the government could do that would improve on the market outcome, give the government the power to do it. And the alternative, which came in with the work, in particular, of Buchanan and Tulloch, the public choice theory, was to say, wait a minute, let's think of the government as itself a marketplace, as itself a political market where people are achieving their objectives, spending resources, making exchanges. So we're going under a different set of rules than the private market. What will happen is not, in general, what ought to happen, what we would not have. I'm arguing you need to apply the same principle here. And that then sort of, once you start thinking about it that way, a lot of examples pop up. And the one which first got me thinking that way actually was an online argument. Because I was making a proposal for a variant of this. The proposal I was making at the time, which I think is in one of my old articles, is a criminal system where when you convict somebody, he is sentenced to X years or Y dollars. He is sentenced to 2 years or $15,000. And what does that mean? It means that he can pay a $15,000 fine, he can go home. If he can't pay a $15,000 fine, one thing he can do is sit in jail for 2 years. But there's an alternative. He can accept an offer from a private jail, which is going to be a factory. And the private jail's offer is, look, it's going to take you 2 years sitting in there, not in their pretty dingy jail, to serve out your sentence. But if you come to our private jail, we figure we can make more than $15,000 out of your labor and feed you and guard you as well. So therefore, we will agree that if you will work for us, we'll pay off your fine at $15,000 a year. You get to inspect our jail if you're getting into it. You can resign and go back to your old jail if you want, so we can't. You aren't enslaved in the normal sense of the term. But as long as working your fine off is a better deal for you than sitting it off, you'll do it. And that struck me as sort of a pretty unambiguous improvement. Part of the reason I was thinking about it, this is the context of stuff we'll be doing in another couple of weeks, was I was thinking about ways of converting criminal law into tort law. And one of the problems, if you want to convert criminal law into tort law, is how do you get people to pay the tort damages, which are the incentive for suing them. And so I was trying to get a way in which you would sort of squeeze money out of the stone, so to speak. And one of the people I was arguing with online said, yeah, the European colonial powers had that system. When they wanted a road built, they would find some excuse to arrest a bunch of the locals, and then their sentence would be to work on the road. And I then remembered a bit in H.L. Mencken. Have any of you ever read H.L. Mencken? No. I recommend. He was a journalist, essayist, who started writing sometime before World War I and basically stopped writing sometime before World War II. And in the period between, I don't think there is any current author who is as influential as Mencken was then. Walter Lippmann described him once as the most powerful man in America. And basically, if you were an aspiring young intellectual, you wanted people to know that you read Mencken, that he was the person that such people expected to read. He was a cynic. He was very bright, wrote beautifully, sometimes tongue-in-cheek. So if you want to read essays, he's sort of one of the great essays in the English language, modern. Anyway, he tells the following anecdote somewhere, I don't remember where, that there's a small-town police chief somewhere out in rural America who likes his jail to be a nice jail, in good condition. So once a year, he'll send his deputies out to the local bars, and the instructions to the deputies are, I want one carpenter, one painter, and one plumber. And, you know, people in bars often do things which give you some plausible excuse for arresting them. So they bring in a painter, a plumber, and a carpenter. He spends a couple of days getting his jail fixed up and repainted, and then he turns them loose again. And that struck me as a sort of milder version of the same story and the same problem. And it then occurred to me that that was the basic problem with my efficient punishment, which the really efficient punishments, was that they offered an opportunity to get your hands around the right levers of power to essentially expropriate other people. And from an economic standpoint, setting up institutions which let some people expropriate others is just asking for a very expensive rent-seeking kind of struggle on both sides. And then it occurred to me, well, isn't that really what people complain about with regard to punitive damages? With regard to people who are critical of the tort system as it now exists, what is their argument? It is that because by persuading a credulous jury that this company has done huge amounts of damage, you might, if you were lucky, be able to get $100 million from them. You can persuade the company to give you $5 million to drop the charges. And then there's then lots of litigation on the basis. I am not an expert on the tort system. I'm not offering an opinion whether this criticism is right, but it's at least a coherent and plausible criticism. Similarly, arguments about civil forfeiture. How many people know about anything about civil forfeiture?
Yeah, so when you break a, you're committing a crime.
You don't have to commit a crime.
Oh.
Your property commits a crime.
Oh, right, right. What do you use your property?
Your property is used in an illegal fashion, and the property then forfeits. And the proof is by civil standard, by a preponderance of the evidence, and it does not require that the owner of the property be claimed to have done anything wrong. Just that the property has. It's sort of funny because one of the things that people occasionally, modern people, sort of in some context say, well, look at the ancient law, the foolish Anglo-Saxons who had a something called a deodand, which was an object convicted of committing a crime. So your axe falls on you and kills you, and the axe is convicted of murder. Well, there is a real case which is called something like the State of California versus Six Cans of Film. I don't remember if it's the right of Six Cans, but I think it's California, I'm pretty sure. And that's a forfeiture case. And so forfeiture has the obvious potential of collecting lots of money for whoever is getting forfeited to. And in many, as I understand the history, a good many states saw the problem and therefore set up their laws so that the forfeited property went somewhere far away from the police department, went to the education fund or something. Then the federal government instituted forfeiture. And at some point, the federal laws were amended so that the federal law enforcement could adopt a forfeiture made by local law enforcement and then divide the proceeds with the local law enforcement. So this is a way of getting around these restrictions. That's right. Drug is where it's important. And Bruce Benson is the guy who I got a good deal of this time. By his account, you can see the results. And after that change in federal law, there's a big shift of law enforcement agency towards drugs because drugs have a lot of money involved with them and are therefore a good, profitable way of getting forfeiture. So again, it's the same basic argument that you have to think about that from the standpoint of the owner of the property, there is a logic for the forfeiture. It seems sort of unjust, but you can say, look, we want to give people an incentive to make sure that they don't lend their cabin cruiser to someone who's going to use it to smuggle drugs. How do we do that? Well, they'll lose the cabin cruiser if they do. So it's not an absurd idea. It may or may not be a good idea. But then you think about the incentives for law enforcement, and you realize that you're giving them an incentive to target their activities at forfeitable property rather than at committing dangerous, at preventing dangerous crimes. And I think there's a good deal of evidence in various contexts of that. So all of these are really the same story. And as I mentioned in the book, I discovered before or after I published the article, on this, certainly after I thought of the ideas, that one of the science fiction writers I think well of, Larry Niven, had seen the same thing years before I did. Because Niven has a series of stories which start out, I quoted a bit of it in the book, with this shift towards various governments saying that if you're going to execute somebody, you might as well transplant his organs for people who need organs. Horrible. I just think that every time we execute somebody, we're also killing a couple of innocent people. There's one guy who could have used his heart, one guy who could have used his lungs. Not to mention keeping another innocent person blind who could have used his corneas, and so forth. So it's, you know, it sounds like a very persuasive argument. And then in Niven's story, you can see as the sequence goes that what's happening is there's then a pressure to make the definition of capital offenses wider and wider because there are still people who need organs. the particular story, the first story, I think, in the sequence, is the one where you finally realize that the reason the guy is going to be executed is that he was convicted of dangerous driving several times, breaking the speed limit and a couple of running red lights, I think, if I remember correctly, the list of offenses. It's a neat point. Niven is quite good. Niven may be the best ID, certainly one of the two best I can think of idea people in modern science fiction. And some of his stuff is co-authored with Jerry Purnell, who is not as good an idea person, but I think is a better writer, a better storyteller, basically. And so the combination, sometimes, it doesn't always work, but the combination sometimes produces very good books. All right, now the one point that I've sort of skipped over at this point is, what does this have to do with the death penalty? Death penalty is sort of a lively issue, has been for a long time, and most of the arguments on the death penalty focus on whether or not it deters murder. My guess is that it does. Sort of we'd expect as the economists, and I think that's what the evidence suggests, although it's a complicated question. But I'm at least hinting at a different kind of argument. And then you say, but wait a minute, as long as we don't forfeit the organs, it's never profitable to hang somebody, it's just cheap. And then the response is, that's true. And we then have two different problems with having a very serious and very cheap punishment available, which is what the death penalty. I should say, modern death penalty is not cheap, but that's only because we don't believe in it, because we have a legal system largely dominated by people who are skeptics about the death penalty, and therefore make it very, very hard and expensive to oppose it. But if you think about people who take it seriously, like, you know, the U.S. in the 19th century, or Britain in the 19th and 18th century, it's very cheap to hang people or put a bullet in their head or something like that. And so the argument then, there are two arguments. The first argument is, we don't have a mechanism to make the legal system do the right thing. And we'd like to worry about how wrong the things are it can do. And it seems quite plausible on public choice grounds that in political systems some people's values get weighted more heavily than other people's values. And you then start worrying that if the values of the people who might be convicted of crimes have very little political influence, and the values of the people who want to be protected from crime have a lot, as long as punishing people is expensive, there's at least some limit to how many people you're willing to punish, because the people who are afraid of crime are also taxpayers that want to pay for all those prisons. And that once you have a system where, all right, take off his head, take off his head, take off his head, take off his head, now you're going to worry that when the system goes wrong, when you have a political situation where the potential victims have leverage and the people guilty or otherwise who might commit crimes don't, that you could heavily overpunish. So that would be one argument. The other argument is that even if a particular punishment isn't profitable, there's always the possibility of out-of-court settlements. That if I have the ability to easily get you hanged, then I have a very viable threat to say, do something that does profit me, and in exchange I'll let you go, or at least I'll give you some more mild punishment. And I still have that if all I can do is lock you up for life, but not as effectively, because it's not as believable when I threaten to lock people up for life if I know that's going to get me into political hot water because of all those crowded jails, than it is if I can just hang them and get rid of them. And it is, I think, clear that out-of-court settlements are common in criminal law, are frequently corrupt, I think, by our standards. I happen to know somebody who a very long time ago was convicted of, I guess, theft. And he says that he was entirely innocent, and I believe him, given having knowing him and interacting with him for a long time. It had a striking effect on his life. But basically, his version of the story is that he had a stranger as a roommate. The stranger had stolen some stuff and put it in the apartment they were both in. He didn't know it was stolen. At some point, the police show up. The stranger claims the roommate claims he did it and is willing to testify against him, and therefore he is the one who ends up getting blamed. But another part of his story is that he was imprisoned in a cell with somebody who had been accused of another and much more serious crime. Somebody who was accused of having murdered, I think, a particular local politician, if I remember correctly. And it was made clear to him afterwards that if by any unlikely chance his cellmate had confessed to that crime to him, that the prosecutors would look much more kindly on his offense. All right. Well, you can see the opportunity that threats have to purchase perjured testimony. And I gather it is the case that it is not uncommon for somebody who is in prison to testify that under those circumstances his cellmate confessed to him. It strikes me as a very unlikely thing to really happen, but a very obvious way of doing this sort of thing. And you can think of other versions of the thing, same thing. There was a scandal in Philadelphia 10 or 15 years ago when it turned out that a bunch of cops had been framing people in order to make them testify against other people, basically. So in any case, so that's the argument, and sort of one of the many things I find interesting about this is that there's a tendency to think of economic analysis of law as sort of a right-wing or at least a libertarian plot. And this is a particular case where it generates a new argument for what's generally been a left-of-center crusade, namely opposition to the death penalty. And I think that the right way to think of it really is it is a tool for understanding certain questions. Such tools can be used to generate arguments for all sorts of different things. It's not like it's got built in. It's got to go, it's got to go over from law and econ doesn't have to go Republican, so to speak. Law and econ does whatever it does. Another point which I discuss in the chapter, and I'm just going to touch on briefly because I think it's sort of neat, is that I'm claiming that the argument I'm offering against efficient punishment is also an explanation of why cannibalism is taboo in essentially all human societies. That I should say, the claim that it's taboo in essentially all human societies is a controversial claim, because there are various anthropological reports which claim at least ritual cannibalism in various societies. There's also quite an interesting book called The Man-Eating Myth, which argues that those reports are evidence of the credulity of anthropologists. And he didn't find an anthropologist. And he basically, his story at least, is he got interested in cannibalism, so he asked him, who is it who has studied, who really has evidence? And he's always pointed at someone. He goes to somebody and says, not me. And he keeps sort of being passed around. And his conclusion is that what's really going on is that all societies think of cannibalism as horrible. And that therefore you study tribe A, and tribe A says, tribe B across the river, they're really terrible. Why, they eat human beings. And the anthropologist writes down, tribe B is human beings. And as he points out, the same testimony includes things such as, how do they get the human beings? Well, they make hollow logs that are submarines, and they go in the submarines under the water, and they pull people down, and quite unbelievable accounts. You only believe them. That's the cannibalism. Now, there's some evidence against it. First, there's one famous case, which as far as I can tell, he never really adequately explains away, and there's also some more recent evidence, which at least has been taken as evidence of cannibalism in Papua New Guinea. But I think he's probably right that it is, if not universal, a very, very common rule that cannibalism seems as evil and wicked thing to do. One of his other cases that was also interesting involves the South American Indians in the early period of the conquest, where there's this story that shows up in various places that involves cannibalism by them. And he points out that the story starts out with a Spaniard, who in his account of his adventures gives a verbatim account of the conversation among the Indians at a point when he did not speak their language, having just arrived. And that the same account is the source of like six different sources. If you actually look at it, they're just repeating it. But anyway, but even if we limit it to cannibalism, it's almost always seen as a terrible thing. My argument is that it makes sense that human societies would have that norm, because in a primitive society, it wouldn't be an issue for us. I mean, none of us is worth enough on the hoof as meat to be a motive for a murder. But if you think about a primitive society when there has a famine, that's not true anymore. And therefore, one would have serious worries about people killing other people unless there was some mechanism to discourage doing that. And that's at least the argument that I'm offering. As you may know, there's a rather interesting book called Cannibalism and the Common Law, which deals with a somewhat bizarre legal case in England. And this was the other kind of cannibalism which clearly exists, which is starvation cannibalism. And this is the case of a shipwreck where at some point, I think they may have drawn straws for who would be killed and then kill somebody and eat him. And then they eventually get rescued. And they tell the story of what happened. And to their astonishment, they're arrested. And apparently their belief, which I think the author of the book thinks is correct, is that the norms of sailors, essentially, the accepted rules of behavior, were, yes, if you are shipwrecked and there's nothing else to eat, you are entitled to randomly choose some member, maybe all agree to it in advance, I'm not sure if that's a requirement, and then kill him and eat him. And here they were being arrested for doing this, and at least the view of the book, I think, is that the relevant English legal authorities wanted to establish a precedent and were in various ways sort of twisting the process in order to get the precedent they wanted against what was then customary. All right, I mentioned last time... Oh, I should say the other relevance of all of this is to the issue of organ markets. Because, as you probably know, the current situation is that there are lots of people who die for lack of transplant organs. And the current situation is there is no legal market in transplant organs. Essentially, you can only get transplant organs pretty much if the owner of those organs voluntarily at no price agrees to give them to you, which normally you do in a will or by signing something on your driver's license that says that if you're in an auto accident, they can harvest your organ, stuff like that. And the obvious response of the economist, of course, is, well, funny thing, you set the price at zero, you have a shortage. Who would have thought that? And then the obvious response for the economist is what you ought to do is to have a legal organ market and to say that I can write in my will that when I die, my organs may be harvested, sold, and the money can go into my estate for my heirs. If I'm really desperate, I got two kidneys, I only need one, I can sell one of them. And we do that for blood, that it's possible to donate blood and be paid for it. But it's the only case, I think. And then the question, what's wrong with that argument? As far as I can see, other than people's sort of gut-level feeling that there's something wrong with selling organs, which is not much of an argument, the one problem is, again, the rent-seeking problem. The fact that if organs are expensive, then there is a reason to murder people. Or to fiercely murder them. I mean, if you're in control of the local legal system in China or something, in some one province of China, you find it excuses to execute people and you then sell their organs. And if it's private enterprise versions in America, you get some guy drunk, take him home with you, maybe you're a pretty girl or your assistant is a pretty girl to give him an incentive, and once he passes out, you remove, say, his kidneys, that won't kill him immediately, and sell them and leave him with a note. Leave him in the bathtub is sort of an urban legend version with a note telling him you better see a doctor really fast. Or if you're really unscrupulous, you just disassemble them entirely and sell everything. So that's a problem. My guess is it's a soluble problem. That is that at least in a society like the U.S., you could have adequate chain of title precautions so that you could say the only way you can sell it is when you have died in a hospital, filled out the right paperwork, and wouldn't entirely solve the problem because somewhere there's going to be someone working for a hospital who sees an opportunity to convert black market organs into legal market. But I think you could probably control most of them. I guess, I don't know. Anyway, that's in a sense. Oh, yes?
I've heard that argument brought up before, and the basis that organs are incredibly expensive. And, you know, these days, if you have money, you can get yourself an organ.
Yep.
The reason why it's so expensive is because there's no supply.
But we don't know how cheap they would be if there were a supply. You're perfectly right that we're going to overestimate it for that reason. But it is not, I think, absurd to think that they would still, that you would still be worth $50,000 or $100,000 on the hoof, counting all of your organs, and that might easily be enough to.
There's also would be a lot of costs. Of
there would be.
And
black markets are expensive to operate on.
It seems that the people, a lot of people before the argument still, it's based on that gut reaction.
It might be.
You know, stealing a car. It shouldn't be that much difference for the incentives involved
in the in any case, it's I don't know what the numbers are, and we aren't going to know, and we also don't know how soon we'll be able to grow organs, which is a superior technology because you can grow it from your own cells and thus not have transplant problems. On the other hand, we also don't know how, as we improve our medical technology, the demand for organs might go up because there are more things that can be solved that way. That is, it's an easy answer, but it does seem to me at least an interesting question. All right, I mentioned last time towards the end Payne versus Tennessee, which is this case which I've got an article on my webpage about, an old published article, and I reread the article, most of it, for my own curiosity, and the story is that the Supreme Court held that it was legitimate for the prosecution in the death penalty phase to introduce evidence about the victim. And the obvious economist's argument is to say, well, one of the things that determines proper penalties is damage done. One of the things that determines damage done when you kill somebody is the somebody. And that may be sort of offensive to sort of legal rhetoric, but in fact, no one really believes that all human beings are equally valuable, even if we say so. So that's one, and that's one possible answer, the economist's answer. But I noticed that in the article, I have a different answer as an alternative, and one which is, suppose we accept this all human beings. Suppose we either say it's morally unacceptable to recognize that some people's lives are worth more than others, or we say we're afraid of the consequence of recognizing that, because then unpopular people won't get protected by the law, in effect. Or we say that there's a constitutional obligation to provide equal protection of the law to everybody, so even if economists say that lives are a different value, the law can't. Suppose we take any of those arguments. There then remains another possible argument in favor of the humane result. And that argument is to say we're not trying to emphasize the importance of the life of this victim compared to another victim. We're trying to emphasize the value of the life of this victim compared to the life of the murderer. Because if you think of the normal death penalty procedure, it is perfectly legitimate for the defendant's side to bring in testimony to the fact that the murderer is also a husband, a father, a child, has humans who care about him, all of that stuff. And so you could not implausibly argue, look, if that's all we have, we're going to get a biased picture. That the victim, the actual victim of this crime, or the potential victims who we're trying to deter the killing of by punishing this person, they're sort of distant abstracts. Whereas here you've got a living, breathing human being you're considering killing. That's the wrong comparison. That you want the jury to be visualizing a trade-off between the life of this living, breathing human being who you're considering executing and the life of a living, breathing human being who might be killed if you don't execute him, assuming that you believe that death penalties deter, which is at least the main argument for doing it. So we then say, all right, well, we happen to have a living, well, not no longer living, but recently living, breathing human being who is in a good position to be put in front of the jury in order that they will realize why there's an argument for executing people, namely the victim. So therefore, allow testimony about the victim to balance the testimony about the offender. And that, it seems to me, I don't find that really as clean and satisfactory as my version of the argument, but it slots better, I think, into legal doctrine in the U.S., which does take this as we're all equal business. Finally, the final chunk of that article, which I wanted to talk about a little bit because I thought it was sort of fun, is what philosophers refer to as the problem of moral luck. And that's a problem we've discussed before in the context of why attempted murder and murder have different punishments, because it's not morally virtuous to be a bad shot. And in the context of if somebody drives drunk and runs over a child, he gets a much more severe punishment than if he ran over a puppy or a tree, even though it may well be that, given how he was driving, the only difference is what happened to be in his way, which he's not responsible for. And different version of the same problem going beyond criminal law is that if you happen to know that that nice elderly man who works in the butcher shop had been a concentration camp guard during World War II and had been responsible for killing a number of prisoners, you would feel very badly about him. But you wouldn't feel badly about him if you happened to know that careful research had shown that 83% of people, if they had grown up in Nazi Germany and been offered a job as a concentration camp guard, would have taken it. So even though, arguably, the only difference between that guy and the elderly butcher in the other butcher shop, which is not a German butcher shop, let's say, the only difference is that one of them had the bad luck to be born in Germany in 1912 or something, and the other didn't, and yet you feel morally different about it. So the real problem is, how is it that our moral judgments depend on things they shouldn't depend on? That we feel that sort of, if you try to analyze it rationally, it seems as though I ought to think badly about you only because you are a bad person. because you chose to drive drunk knowing it might kill a kid or a puppy or even a tree. And yet we actually feel very differently about you according to what would seem like morally irrelevant questions about what actually happened, not determined by you. And I think there are a number of possible answers. My favorite answer, I'm not sure I agree with it, but I thought it was really a neat one, is from Adam Smith. As some of you may know, what made Smith famous was not The Wealth of Nations, which is the book he's now famous for, but his first book, which is called The Theory of Moral Sentiments, and is about, in a sense, moral philosophy. It's an interesting book. And he actually devotes, if I remember correctly, about 3 chapters to this question. And he argues that obviously, it's obvious to anybody who thinks about it, that our moral judgments about people ought to be about what they intended, about what happened inside their head. But it's equally obvious that no one acts that way. And that the person who got mad at someone, and if there had happened to be a gun available, would have shot him. But there wasn't. We don't feel anything like as badly as a similar person who did. That's not his example, but he has other examples. And now he says, why is this? And his answer is, this is evidence of divine benevolence. This particular pattern of irrationality is highly desirable. Why is it desirable? Because we are not competent to judge people on the inside of their heads. And we are competent to judge people on what they do. And part of what I thought was interesting, and again, I read this years ago, so I can't give you exact quotes, but we tend to think of the question in terms of, should we forgive the concentration camp guard? Smith looks at it the other way around. He says, well, look, we all know that Catholics would murder the king if the Pope told them to. Right? This is England, where Catholicism was the out religion ever since the 16th century. So therefore, if we follow the principle of it's the inside of your head, we can execute all of the Catholics as people who would have committed murder, they just didn't, the relevant circumstances didn't happen to arrive. And given that human beings have the kind of prejudices they do, if we felt free to punish people on the grounds of sort of their internal moral standing, we would do all sorts of injustices. So therefore, he says, the right rule is let God take care of punishing people as they really deserve, and let humans punish on the basis of actual activity. And I thought that was a fairly nice argument. But it also sort of suggests to me something which struck me a long time ago, that really our moral intuitions are of two very different sorts. One of which I think of as a God's eye and a man's eye version. And one way of putting it, borrowing one word from Nozick, is the distinction between what you deserve and what you're entitled to. And the simplest example of the distinction is to imagine we have a society where somehow the existing holdings of wealth are all just. Everybody's got whatever he should have. And in that society, you and I make a bet. We bet a dollar on the flip of the coin. Coin comes out your way, I hand you a dollar. Are you entitled to it? You surely don't deserve it. Because after all, you didn't deserve to have the coin come up heads any more than I deserved to have. You did nothing. Nothing having to do with your virtue resulted in you getting that dollar. And yet we have a very strong intuition that you're entitled to it because you got it by a legitimate means. Because it was my dollar, we started out with a just distribution, and I agreed to make it then. So that, I think, sort of emphasizes that distinction. And part of the way I think of it, which is related to Smith's point, though I think it predated my reading Smith, is that the desert criterion makes sense if you're God for two different reasons. One of them is that you know what people deserve, you can look into their heads, and the other is that you don't face a budget constraint. That is to say, you can give them whatever they deserve. Human beings, on the other hand, have a double problem. First, we can't look into each other's heads. I'm really no more competent to judge you than you are to judge you. And second, we do have a budget constraint. So if my careless driving smashes your car, we don't have the option of saying, well, it wasn't really my fault, it wasn't really your fault, poof, the car's back again. God would have that option. We don't. Someone's got to pay for that car, and therefore a system of entitlements which says here are the rules saying who's obligated to do what works much better for dealing with that than a system where the court has to say, well, are you morally at fault? If you are, we'll punish you. If not, not. Anyway, that, some of that I think is in the article. If you're curious, it's up on my webpage, like many of my articles. So I will see you all. Oh, I was going to say about these papers that you people are supposed to be, not papers, short papers, essays that you're supposed to be writing, that take some legal case and apply economic analysis of law to it. I had thought incorrectly that I had said on the syllabus what the deadline was. But what I think I said at least in class a couple of times was they ought to be done not long after we discuss the irrelevant areas of law. And so what I think I'm going to make it is that next week is antitrust. That's the last class, which is on an area of law rather than sort of various other summaries and things. So by the class, by the week after next week, by 2 weeks from now, by the end of that week, you should have either handed in or offered as a class presentation your view of the application of economic analysis to some real-world law case. And the only restriction is that it's supposed to be your view, so you're not supposed to take one that I or Posner have already discussed.
Questions?
No. All right, let's all go home then.